What does ethnicity have to do with breast cancer?
The potential overtreatment of diabetes.
Managing cardiovascular risk factors on a community-wide basis really does help.
And the inappropriate use of aspirin in preventing heart disease.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 16th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, we've got some heart disease things to talk about and one study in particular that I really like. So let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. A look at a community-wide program for managing three specific cardiovascular risk factors and the pretty profound impact that had over a long period of time.
You know, Elizabeth, there are really very few reports of comprehensive cardiovascular risk reduction programs, and especially those that are centered at the community level, and even more particularly in rural or low-income areas. So that's why this particular study carries a lot of weight. Now, I know, Elizabeth, you already talked to somebody else about this beforehand. How do you want to approach this particular study?
I'm willing to approach it however you like. I really feel that this is such a good news thing that we can look at it from any angle.
Okay, so let's set it up for our listeners. This was a 40-year observational study, and they started sequentially. They decided to first attack hypertension, then they looked at cholesterol, then they looked at smoking. They looked at evidence-based medicine and what interventions could possibly affect these risk factors. They involved measured and monitored objectives. They incorporated lay and professional leadership in the community, which is really important. And they combined that with primary care clinicians and community participation in designing the program and implementing it and monitoring it. So all of this done at the community level in a very low-income rural area. This affected 150,000 individual county residents over the 40 years. They were able to increase blood pressure control, an absolute increase of 25%, increased the level of people that had their cholesterol controlled, an absolute increase of 29%. They increased smoking cessation from 50% to 70%. They had fewer hospitalizations. They had improved mortality.
Roar. We love these kinds of interventions. I think other things that are noteworthy is the dollar number we can put on savings with regard to hospitalizations. And then the other little stat that I thought was really cool was that this particular county in rural Maine had started out with a mortality rate that was actually higher and then afterwards ended up lower than everyone else. So clearly there's a really great impact of this. One of the questions I have about it is, what did it cost to implement?
They don't tell the actual cost, but what they do say is the following. One, it's a rural, low-income area. And in fact, over the course of the 40 years, the poverty level increased from 9% to 17% in this county. The population got older. And so how did they do this on a shoestring? Well, they did it by involving the community. They have a small number of seed grants. The whole effort was intense from the beginning, and the duration was sustained over a long period of time. So the real question is, can this be applied to other communities? And I think the answer is yes. What this says is we can do something at a community level that has measurable outcomes, reduce hospitalization and reduce mortality.
Indeed, such good news. One other final point I would make about this is that I think there are two features of this program that are worth noting. One of them is its comprehensive nature. The other is its targeted nature. So this material was really focused on a specific population with communicating with that population very much in mind.
Exactly.
Of course, that's the one I'll be doing on the blog. Let's just stay in the Journal of the American Medical Association and let's take a look at this recurrent issue, ethnicity and breast cancer. We see this ethnicity brought up again and again as factors in so many places, and here's another.
Of all the cancer diagnoses in the United States, about 14% are represented by breast cancer. Obviously, we want to detect it in its early stage because women with early stage breast cancer are expected to have the best survival. And the authors address that by looking at a very large population, over 370,000 women with invasive breast cancer, and looked at their survival according to their ethnicity. And they did that so they could determine the portion of breast cancers that were identified in early stage in each of these ethnicities to determine if any of the differences were due to either rates of early detection or whether there were actually biologic differences and tumor aggressiveness. And here's what they found out. Among the U.S. women that were diagnosed with breast cancer, the likelihood of a diagnosis at an early stage varied by race and ethnicity. African-American women were less likely to be diagnosed at stage one, and much of this was due to not differences in early detection, but actually biologic differences in the tumor itself. Across 8 different ethnicities, if women had a very small tumor in African-Americans, it was more likely to already metastasize to the lymph nodes, to other organs. It was more likely to lead to death, 2 times more likely than in other races. Conversely, in the Asian population, they were less likely to be diagnosed with early stage cancer because of screening. So this information is very helpful in terms of addressing breast cancers in women of different ethnicities.
And so, does this suggest that African American women ought to be screened earlier in their lifetime, more often?
It's impractical to say we need to screen somebody every 3 months, for example. But it does suggest that because the tumors are different, we need to address them differently in terms of how we stage or how we administer therapy. These African-American women are more likely to have hormone receptor negative tumors. So I think we need to modify treatment based upon these biologic differences.
There's that, but there's also clearly the need to identify what is the biological basis by which these very early tumors are different in these women.
I would agree with that.
Let's go from here then to JAMA Internal Medicine. The idea that, oops, sometimes we're giving too many people aspirin.
There are some people that joke that aspirin ought to be in the drinking water, like some of the statin medications. For people that have known cardiovascular disease, we know that aspirin can be particularly important in preventing a second event. We call this secondary prevention. And so these individuals should clearly be on aspirin unless there's some contraindication. The issue with primary prevention has been a little bit thornier recently. And based upon current recommendations, patients that have a high risk of having cardiovascular disease should be on aspirin, and those on a low risk shouldn't. You say, well, what's the harm of an aspirin? The use of aspirin is associated with an increased risk of strokes from bleeding, a hemorrhagic stroke, and an increased risk of severe bleeding, usually gastrointestinal bleeding. So what this study did was very simple. Based on the current recommendations that people with a less than 6% chance of having heart disease over 10 years, those should not receive aspirin. Those with a greater than 6% should be considered for it. How many people are receiving it inappropriately? And they looked at almost 69,000 patients. And what they determined is that 1 in 10 of them are receiving aspirin when they shouldn't be.
And while I'm okay with accepting that this is a statistic, I would add to this equation the idea that some people take aspirin prophylactically for colorectal cancer, and other people are prophylaxing for, we've recently reported on this relationship in melanoma risk reduction. So I'm just wondering if these folks who may be so-called inappropriately taking aspirin based on reduction of cardiovascular disease risk aren't in fact taking it for another purpose.
That's a great point. Let me address that by bringing 2 issues to mind. One is these were all cardiology practices, so it's unlikely that they were receiving it for cancer prevention. But furthermore, if you look at the practices of the cardiology groups, the range of inappropriate use ranged from almost 0% to as many as 70% of patients. So Elizabeth, this I have to put on the backs of the cardiologists.
I'm going to give you this point, but I'm going to also predict that we're going to be talking a lot more about aspirin. Finally then, let's turn to another issue in JAMA Internal Medicine, and this is the idea of diabetes over treatment.
We've talked about the importance of proper control of diabetes, preventing eye disease, preventing kidney disease, trying to prevent cardiovascular disease and death. And the control of diabetes is particularly important in the younger population because it takes decades for the manifestations of diabetes to be revealed. The implication is in older individuals, especially those that have a lot of serious comorbidities, the tight control of diabetes really is not indicated. In fact, it could be harmful because we know the tighter the control, the more likely it is to cause low blood sugar or hypoglycemia, which can lead to death and severe neurologic problems. And those are more likely to occur in the older individuals as well. So this was an analysis, looked at the potential overtreatment of diabetes in older individuals. They looked at almost 1,300 older adults over the age of 65 with diabetes. And over that 10-year period, what they determined is it's about 60% were being overtreated with no benefit and potential harm.
This reminds me, of course, of other studies we've seen in the older population suggesting that tight glycemic control in older folks, especially those in the ICU, for example, can result in a deleterious outcome. I made this suggestion to you in the past. Wow, there's a temporal medicine, if you will, that's called upon here. At different points in people's lifetimes, we ought to have different standards.
I think you're absolutely right, Elizabeth. Based upon their numbers, the estimate is that there are 1.8 million persons that are old and have significant comorbidities in which they're trying to maintain tight glycemic control.
Definitely something worth considering. And again, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say we're going to hear more about this. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.